lost the weight upon my shoulder. Now it's easier to walk. I can see the road before me. I am not afraid to fall.
Welcome to the Beautiful Shifts podcast today. We're excited for this episode. Her name is Susie Augenstein. She is awesome. We've both kind of followed her on Facebook. She lives in the area where we live, but we've never like crossed paths. So it was such a fun conversation, and she just has so much wisdom.
Yes, for sure. She's awesome. And I did like, I think, I don't know that we shared like her contact info at the end of that episode, actually.
Oh, that's right.
So I was just thinking like, if anyone, if you really love what she says, which I'm sure that you will, because she's amazing, you can look her up on Facebook and see like all of her past posts too.
Yeah. She's just very thoughtful in how she talks and about controversial things that I think when she says them, like you can tell she's seeing both sides, but also being true to her thoughts and
beliefs. She kind of like weighs in on things, but you can tell she really thinks it through. It's not done in a, even in like a divisive way at all. It's very loving, but she's just kind of explaining.
And she's a beautiful writer.
She is a really good writer. So we just loved the conversation. It was great to finally connect with her. So thanks so much, Susie. We loved it.
So we'll cover a couple transitions in her story that might like be applicable to a lot of you. So one is like empty nesters, like her kids have moved out of her home. And then she also dealt with a child with addiction and kind of finding peace through that, you know, kind of trial in life.
Her finding peace. And then she also talks about her faith evolution, and it was super interesting, and we loved everything that she had to share. So we are just excited for this one. Really excited, and
excited to share.
We know you guys will love her, and on all those points she has such well thought out, like we talked about. She just really prepared well, and
had a lot of advice for listeners
and like perspectives and things. So it's a great conversation.
Yes, we loved it. We were, I don't know if any of you have heard about the David Archuleta song that just came out. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's called Hell Together. And we were just talking about it just before recording this intro, how beautiful it was and how much we loved it and how touching it was. And then we thought, oh, maybe we should mention that, because part of Susie's faith evolution is, it kind of started out with her supporting the LGBTQ community and then which kind of led down that path. So, we just felt like it kind of lended itself well to this conversation. So we don't know if you've listened to it or heard it, but we just highly recommend it. It's beautiful.
It's kind of a beautiful, touching just lyrics, and he just got such a good voice. And I just love the style of the song. I don't know. It was just really pretty. Very touching.
And it's about his mom's response to him when he came out. And so I think just as mothers, like it was very touching to us. And of course, everyone's going to have a different take, because it has to do with him leaving his religion as well. But I think it's his story, and it's his, you know, his feelings and his mom's feelings, and it communicates that. So, and I just love him. He's always been such a great guy. That song Glorious of his, I still just love it.
Pretty.
It's such a good song. And it talks about how like we're all, you know, part of the same symphony. It just kind of reminds me of like humankind and how we're all just in this together. And
he just seems like such a thoughtful, nice person. And then his mom is just so cute. And I think as mothers, you can feel that in the story, like the mother's love you have for your kid, like this unconditional love that you just want to support and love them. So super good. So if take a listen.
Definitely. Okay, all right, well, enjoy Susie, and thanks for listening.
Thank you. All right. Welcome to the podcast today. We're so excited to have with us Susie Augenstein. Hi, Susie.
Hi.
We've been wanting to have you on for a while, and we live just right down the street from each other, but haven't crossed paths yet. But we both, we all live in Riverton. So I'm just going to read a bio, and then we'll just kind of get into your story. And we're really excited to talk about all the transitions that you have to share with us today.
Perfect. Thanks.
Okay, Susie Augenstein is the girl next door who has a gypsy heart. She is a nurse, mom, traveler, wife, questioner, and advocate for all of her close friends who identify as LGBTQ+. She and her husband, Paul, raised 5 kids who are now figuring out young adulthood with all the ups and downs. This new transition as empty nesters has upped their travel game considerably. As a couple, they love to jump outside the Utah bubble and learn about new places, different cultures, and people of all ethnicities and belief systems. When they are not traveling, Susie works as a nurse at the Hope Clinic. She refers to this as her little slice of heaven on earth. She struggles to always make sense of the world, and her biggest goal is to stay in the present moment, which is not always easy with her busy and active mind. Susie believes that her biggest growth spurt came when she learned how to sit in uncertainty and to listen to her own inner voice. This helped her to develop the mindset of that, instead of waiting for heaven, that she could find it in the here and now. She believes that this life is a gift and you only get one chance at it. So get your hands dirty and let both the storms and sunsets of life refine you into a better human. And that, that was beautiful. Just so beautiful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I ask you what the Hope Clinic is? I have heard of it, I feel like, but I wasn't sure what it was.
It's a nonprofit clinic. And so it gives free healthcare for the underserved population. So those that don't have insurance, those that live way below the 30% below the poverty line. It's often immigrants. It's often, you know, people that aren't citizens yet. So it just is a space that they can come, because mostly, like, a lot of people will use the emergency rooms as their healthcare, especially if they don't have insurance. So it's a way to direct them so that we can give them healthcare. And then our emergency rooms are used what they need to be used for. Plus an emergency room is a Band-Aid. We give them like full care and a plan. So it's awesome.
That's really cool.
It's an awesome job. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. How long has it been open?
Well, I've been there for about 13 years. And I think it was opened about 4 years before that. I was just at a period in my life where I went back later to nursing school. I was a teacher at first. And I was at a point in my life that I just needed something in that career that filled me a little bit more. And I just happened to find it. And now I'm really, really close with the people that run it, and they're amazing. It's like working in another country. It's like working with every religion, every diverse, you know, every ethnicity. Like, it's an amazing place. It makes me feel like I can get out of the bubble. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, awesome. And where is it located?
It's on State Street, about 6700. If you just go back, it's a little nook and a little place that everyone is slammed in there, and it's body to body, and we love it. It's amazing.
I love it. So that's neat. a really cool job. I can see why it would be fulfilling, for sure.
Yeah. It's just neat to provide that for people that
If you want to give us a little more background, if you want, with you and your family or anything like that, and then wherever you want to start with your story.
Okay, well, my husband and I actually have known each other since we were 14. We were kind of in the same group of friends throughout junior high and high school, back and forth, some years not as close, but we ended up getting married. We connected more after his mission. I was not a person that was going to wait for anyone on a mission. And we always have a joke about that, because, you know, we had dated a little bit before. And I was just like, no, I'm not waiting. And I was really happy about it, because I feel like that's why we got married, because while he was gone, and as I was dating, I always ended up doing this compare and contrast that I didn't think I was going to do. Because I just thought we were such good friends. And then I told him, it was like while you were sleeping, the movie, that while he was gone, that I figured things out. And I fell in love with him because, you know, when you know someone that long, you just feel like, oh, I got to get out there and do all these other things. But it was awesome. So with him being gone, and once he came back, we really connected. And our friendship has been the best basis for our relationship that we've ever had. It's been awesome, even through our lowest points. And so we got married. We both graduated from BYU. We had three little boys that I had biologically, and then my last two children we adopted. We were done at five, we were done at three. My last kid goes into kindergarten, and I am right ready to get into nursing school, and we adopted. And that's a whole other story, but it's an amazing, I mean, our family has been very blessed with all of the things that have, you know, like I always tell people, you don't write your book. You don't know the chapters in your book. We think we know the chapters in our book, but we don't. And I've always been amazed when a different chapter comes in that's completely different than I thought it would be. And that's kind of part of our family story. So four boys and my daughter at the end. So it's kind that's of awesome. A rough and tumble house. Lots of stories that went into that. But so anyways, what else? I graduated as a teacher, and then I went back about, I think, 15 years later. I'd always wanted to be a nurse, and I had kind of chickened out in college because I was a really good student but a poor test taker when it came to standardized tests. And so I just felt I didn't feel confident that I could pass a big test like the NCLEX. which I would tell everyone now that you can do it. You know, yeah. I probably should have, because it might have been I was kind of a mom early on that it would have been better for me to have a little bit more part-time work. And so anyways, I've loved it. I went back with 5 kids, extremely hard thing to do. Wow. My husband took over the house. He's never given back cleaning or laundry. And
perfect.
And nice. It's been, yeah. So it was an amazing transition. I also think it showed my kids that if you really like want to do something, even with your situation, that you can make it work. You can figure out a way to change things up and do something new if you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's awesome.
Yeah. It's what kind of what Lindsay's going through.
Yeah. I mean, my program is a little more flexible. Probably it's all online, so there's some flexibility, but yeah, it's, my weekends are filled with studying instead of just, you know, but, and so I'm like, well, I guess at least I feel a little guilty sometimes, 'cause I'm like, oh, I'm, you know, having to cram for this or that. But then I'm like, at least I'm giving my kids an example that, like you said, they can change course. They can do something later in life. It doesn't have to be what they chose early on or whatever. Right. So,
and you know what? They're not going to remember, because mine, I laugh because at all their junior jazz games and stuff, I always had note cards and I'm like going, woohoo, cheering them on. And then I'm reading notes, studying. Reading my notes. And when I asked them, like, what did you remember about that? They don't even remember. They're so busy, you know, and they have their own thing. And so they don't remember the fact that I remember more where I wasn't always present. They don't remember that. They think I always was. So.
Yeah. Well, and you remember the juggling of it and kind of the stress behind it where, they're not going to remember that.
Right.
I know. It's true. 'Cause my mom went back to school when I was in high school, and I don't really, I mean, I kind of remember her studying and then being so proud of her for graduating or whatever, but I'm like, I don't remember it affecting
that's interesting.
My relationship with her, or our lives that much. No. So she did. Yeah.
It's good. It's good for kids to see you balance through things. I think we have a misperception that moms have to be so self-sacrificing. And I do think that our kids need to see that balance, and that we aren't their everything either. And they're not our everything.
Mm. Right. So we all have our own things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. I have to remind myself of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's kind of a little background.
Yeah. Oh, that was great. Perfect. I love that. Yeah. Well, we had been talking a little bit before, you know, we started recording this episode, but we both kind of have been following Susie for a while. She just has great thoughts that she'll share on Facebook. And so being in Riverton, we're like, we kind of feel like we know you, but you don't know us.
Right.
One of those situations. But
I feel like you had a lot of profound things during Black Lives Matter, during COVID, during just things that go on in Utah with the church, the LDS church. So I was always just really impressed with your writing. I feel like you were very open-minded about things, but you also spoke your truth or how you saw things. And I actually even loved reading some of the responses, because it was just a really good dialogue. You weren't there to argue, you weren't there to like, but you were there to kind of stick up for the, you know, marginalized, or for what you thought was, you know, good. And I was like, wow, I have a lot of posts saved by you over the years where I'm like, oh, this is so profound, I'm going to go back to this. And so anyway, we wanted to have you on, and we thought you'd just have a lot of wisdom to share and just some background. And
well, and COVID was a time that, like, I keep trying to anticipate how I'm going to enter this election year, because the last one was so difficult for me. And I felt like I had so much to say, because I have Black children, and I have so many close friends that are LGBTQ, and it's really hard to not like say stuff, especially someone like me. And so, you know, you realize you have to be careful on some things, especially like in politics. But at the same time, if we don't say it, then, you know, people need to know how people feel, I believe, you know, and I think you have to do it delicately too.
Yeah. Well, and it helps you not feel alone, because I think like us even seeing your posts and being like, oh, wow, she's wording this so well. And it kind of gives us not like the courage, but you know what I mean? Like kind of that reinforcement that, oh good, there's someone else that like we admire in our community. 'Cause sometimes it's hard if you kind of feel like you're alone in some of your thoughts with this kind of stuff. So,
So I appreciated all your thoughts and different perspectives for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as far as life transitions, what one would you like to discuss first?
Okay. Well, I have some current ones that I would do before we do our other one. And one of them that's been interesting for me is the empty nester transition. And the reason I say that is that I prepared myself. Like I didn't just like, I went, I worked, like I had a part-time job. I had a good circle of friends. I have a very good relationship with my husband. And so I prepared myself thinking that this empty nester stage would be easy. And it wasn't. It wasn't. The first year for me was really, really hard. And it was, I still was busy and it wasn't that, but it was that I am a person that likes noise. I don't know why, but I like noise. And I had five kids. And at the 3 o'clock hour, it was noisy in my house. And there was teenagers and there was just chaos going on, and projects due, and you know, soccer games to go to and theater things. And so when it became quiet, it was hard for me. I just like for a minute, like I always tell my kids this, like within the first 6 months, I always told my kids that the walls were talking to me. I would go down the hall and I'd look into one room and I remember when it was a bunk bedroom, and I'd see little boys in their little plaid pajamas. And then I would go down the stairs and I'd be in the kitchen and I'd see a whole bunch of teenagers that were gathering, because my boys always had all their friends and they were eating all of our food. And so I had these memories just popping out of my walls, because this is the only place we lived in. I mean, I get even emotional thinking about it, because it was just so, you give, like I did, I parented for, at least had kids for 28 years in my home. I mean, that's a full career for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're like, did I really do that? Was I really like, was that my life? Because now that it's like a couple years out and I'm like, oh my gosh, was I a mom? You know?
Yeah.
And so it was just,
well, that's who you identify as for so long. And you're still the mom, but like you said, there's not the chaos anymore. It's no, the quiet.
Not around. Yeah.
And I think it's okay, because like I do think it's necessary to prepare for it and to be something else as well. But I also think it's okay to say, like, that was like a very meaningful job to me, and it was hard. But, you know, and I loved teenagers. That was one of my favorite parts of raising kids. I struggled when they were little. That was not my best motherhood, because I just need people to be able to talk back to me and have a conversation.
Right. Yeah.
But it wasn't. And so I think the biggest thing now that I'm on the other side of it, now that like we, it's so fun watching adult children, so stressful too. I think that's why we go out of town a lot, because we're like, oh gosh, just figure it out. I don't want to, I need to shut my mouth and not say a lot. And I need to let you guys figure out things just the way that we had to. But the one thing I realized in this last year that was like a new perspective was that like there is life beyond motherhood. And realizing that was really, really good for me, because I'm going to be with my husband and myself longer than I parented. Like I'm going to, if I live another 30 years, right, which easily could happen. And so I'm going to do that. So there has to be life. And once I figured out there was life after motherhood, that was helpful. And then I also realized that freedom is both scary and thrilling all at the same time, because you're faced with this freedom that you don't quite know what to do with. And I think it's because I don't think it's a midlife, but I definitely think as women, we enter this space where we're like, oh my gosh, like, what do I do? I don't know if you guys did, but we all got married young.
We
start having kids, blah, blah, blah. Young, and so this freedom that you have, you don't know what to do. And I think some moms tend to be like, well, then now I'm still their mother and I'm a grandmother. And they're always trying to bring the flock in rather than thinking about that they can be a human being. And I think it's important to be a human being and to let your kids see that, you know, like I laugh because when we go out of town, my kids are like, well, are you ever going to be in town? And I'm laughing because I'm like, but when you're busy, like we're
right.
Here.
So, yeah, we're around, we're available.
Right. But it's just funny how they view you as a mom. And then
then you should be. My kids have told me, like, I just expect you to be home whenever I get there and to answer your phone whenever I call.
Right.
You know, but of course I call them and they like, what do you want? And don't even answer the phone call.
Well, and like, I get like a text from my high schooler, like, can you bring me this paper or whatever? I'm like, what if I wasn't home? Like next year I'm going to be doing internships. I won't be like, home all the time. Home. You guys are going to have to adjust. Like,
and it's so, so good for them. I remember learning like, oh, it's so good that your kids, you know, when they get home that they hear their mom's voice. And there's partially, I think that's really good. But I also think there is a part that teaches them a type of independence when they see you have a type of independence, you know, it's just not so intercombined. And then the other thing that I realized as I was growing older, as you can see, like I've started to like pull in the gray in my hair and started to embrace some things then. And I've realized that, like, I'm never going to look as young as I do today. And so
yeah, I've had that thought.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a good thought. Yeah.
This is it. This is the kids good.
Like, instead of looking back, or like, oh, how I looked 10 years ago. Oh,
enjoy the moment now.
I really like that.
Yeah, because you end up doing that. And so I have to, like, tend to, I was kind of worried about aging, but like, I'm going to embrace what is now, because this is the youngest I'm ever going to be. And
again,
yeah. And that's why my husband and I actually have, like, really embraced more travel and stuff, because his dad died of Alzheimer's, and my kids have been doing the DNA tests, and one of my sons has one of the markers, and my husband's going to find out. And we're like, you know what? He was 67. So we're going to embrace what we have, because you don't know, which we should do every day, right? Nobody knows what tomorrow brings. And so, anyways, and so then when I think about, like, the lessons I've learned from this is that one thing you tend to do when you go through empty nesters is you go through this nostalgia period where you're always kind of pushing to the future with your kids, right? When's this going to happen? When this? You become an empty nester, you start to visit the past, and you get this, like, nostalgia thing that happens in you. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome because you're having these great memories, but it's the same as, like, when someone dies, you remember the best. Nobody remembers the worst about when someone dies. And it's a blessing in a way. Same with motherhood. So you remember these great things, but it's a little bit dangerous, because then you talk to, like, a neighbor who has teenagers, and they're giving you the reality. And I'm like, ooh, I remember that. And my nostalgia is faking my brain out. Like, there were things that I wouldn't want to go back to. There were things that were really difficult. And so I think you have to learn to, like, that nostalgia is okay, but don't let it deceive you into that everything was always perfect, you know?
Right. So then you're just constantly living in the past instead of enjoying now, traveling and spending time.
And your
with
past
your husband,
is rose colored. It's not exactly with nostalgia. It's all rose colored. So you don't always remember. And the other thing I learned is that you have to forgive yourself a lot. Like, I always try to do better when I knew better. I'm constantly telling my kids, like, different things that I wish I would have done. But I realize, you know, they're going to repeat it. We all are improving. Like, I tell them all the time, like, you take the best and you get rid of the worst, and then you improve upon it, and go get therapy. Like, I'll pay for it. I don't care. Like, get therapy to get over whatever the worst was, because we all kind of need that. So we kind of joke around about that. And I also feel like one thing I learned is, in the early ages, I always took sometimes teeny little jobs because I just needed them. But if I would have been a better mother early on, if I had had a part-time job in those early years, and I know that some people would balk at that, but for me and my personality, had I been a nurse from the beginning and could have done a couple shifts, I would have been a better, more balanced mother in the early years. And I'm totally fine with that. And I think my kids would have been fine. I think I was a little bit too closed in. I'm a social person, and sometimes it felt very overwhelming to me. Young motherhood did.
Yeah. And I think it's easy to think that we're supposed to, because it's kind of our environment. We're supposed to be a mom and want to be a mom and not want to work. And that's all we are, you know? But I do think I have a few friends that were like that, where they're like, I just can't do it unless I work once or twice a week. I am a better mom because I am giving myself. And I think we're taught to be selfless, when sometimes we do have to. If we're not taking care of ourselves, then we aren't taking care of our kids as well. I always think of, like, the whole analogy of the airplane. Like, we've got to put the oxygen on us first so we can have the energy to do that, you know, help our kids. And I think self-care was kind of almost pushed away. Like, no, you're just a mom and you stay home and you have to take care of your kids and be the everything for your kids. That I would start to feel guilty if I wasn't home when my kids got home from school. Because they would say, well, we just like you here when you're here. Well, of course they do, but doesn't mean they can't make it without us, or that they're that it's good for them to sometimes come home and not have us be here, whatever.
Also, I just think people forget that there's a negotiation process between you and your spouse. I mean, there are some things that you should just negotiate what you're good at. Like, my husband's a far better nurturer than I am. Like, I'm like a boom, blah, blah, you know, like that. And he just is a nurturer. And if it would have been different, he would have been the better stay-at-home parent. He even admits it. He loves it. He likes everything that happens in the home. I don't know why that's such a bad thing, to not be able to negotiate your strengths and be like, you do this better, I do this better. I mean, like, I handle all of our money. He loves that I do that. He handles, you know, so many other things. and we keep each other grounded. So why can't our relationships be more of who's good at what rather than a gender, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I hope that things are moving more that way. I mean, I do feel like it was even different. Like, so I have a 16 and a 14 year old and then 9 year old twins. And I don't know if it's like the presence of social media where you kind of see, you know, people are a little more open about things or what, but I feel like I had a different mindset with the first two than with the second two, you know, a little bit about like this kind of stuff about, I'm thinking, oh yeah, I probably could have worked part time when my, but I just, it just wasn't even an option in my head, you know, when I had those older kids. And I try to think, would I, I probably would, I could have probably done it and maybe it would have been good for me mentally and stuff to, you know, so it is interesting, but I just hope, that, and even the gender role thing that as our kids get older, you know, maybe they have more open discussions with their spouses or future spouses about that, because it doesn't have to be, you know, one size fits all thing.
And it is kind of, I think, to share the balance of things is almost easier if both of them work, both of you work in a sense, because then you're like, well, I can't do this day. You're taking the kids and you've got to cook dinner or go to the grocery store or do laundry. But if you're just the mom that stays home all the time, those things just are still yours always. Even if like your husband's workload becomes less or the kids are getting, I don't know. It's just funny. I feel like some people have a better balance when both parents work because they have to talk about it and they have to decide which jobs they like the best or which ones they're better at or whatever.
I think the biggest thing is to be very open to that. People have different needs for their particular personality. And maybe there's some people that absolutely, I mean, I have friends that love 24/7 motherhood. And I think that's awesome.
Oh, it's awesome. Know? Yeah.
And I think that it's okay if you don't. And I think the thing is that women get pitted against each other because of that sometimes, instead of just being like, why don't we just see what we all like and what suits our personalities that make us function better in the world, you know? Because personality is a big thing. And, you know, as we talk later about maybe some of the faith things, you know, you have a personality that you're given that's not always one that fits in the box of life that you're given. Perfect. And that's a struggle to not be able to honor like who you are inside just because you were kind of put in these different boxes. But anyways, so like, as far as that, I think you said, talk about advice to others. And one of the things I do in this stage is I'd say, make sure you're fostering healthy relationships with your spouse during the years of raising kids. That's one thing I'm so grateful for. I mean, we've had our ups and downs, but the fact that I can now like be in my house alone with my husband and feel like it's a happy place to be. Some people don't get that. So foster it, go on dates, do all the things, travel together that you need to do because you're going to have a lot longer time with just your spouse. And then I also think that you need to just make a plan. Like if there's anyone that's going into empty nesting, make a plan so that the transition will be easier, because it's always going to be a transition, but it will be a lot harder if you just go from motherhood to, wow, what do I do with my life? So just ease into something, whether it's hobbies or classes or travel or back to school or anything like that, or jobs transitions, just make a plan. So I think it will make the transition easier.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I have actually a couple of friends, because I had kids early, but then I had a space, and then I have a 10-year-old. So I have a 23-year-old and a 10-year-old. And so I've made myself be the young mom and the old mom. Mm-hmm. But a couple of my friends didn't have that caboose. And so they are in that stage, and I can see that it is hard for them. Like, just the other day, my friend's like, I just kind of wish I could just go on. Her last son's on a mission. She's like, I kind of wish I could just go in a coma until he gets home. Cause she's just like so sad and misses him so much. And it's like, my other two were like, have been out of the house for a while, and he was my last one. And now I don't know what to do. And
a caboose is good.
Yeah. So I've got myself a caboose that will make it so I won't be too sad, as I have one daughter that's left the house and she's somewhat close, but it's hard. Like, and kind of what you talked about a little bit earlier, like I can't live my life still being her mom. Like, even though it's, I want to be her mom. And so even with advice, sometimes it's like, okay, I have to be careful. This is her life and her choices. And if I'm mothering her like she is 10 instead of 20, like I could burn some bridges there, or I need, or teach her not to like think for herself or make her own decisions. Cause it's so easy to want to keep mothering them.
And the reality of it is that we've had kids move back since you know, high school. It's not the same. I had to learn that, because I was like, what I was missing was these earlier chapters, and I was missing, like, you know, what you do after school and all of those things. And then you have adult children move back and you're kind of like, okay, I understand that you need to be on your own.
Yes, because it's so true.
It's not the same. And so, So that's kind of what I did with that stage. Those are some of the things I've learned with empty nesting. Yeah.
And I love that advice, because actually we haven't really talked about empty nesting, but I remember when we first were starting our podcast, we went to Down East to look for some clothes for our pictures.
Oh yeah.
And the ladies asked why we were getting them. I actually think they thought we were getting engagement pictures.
Oh yeah. We were like, I think
we're getting married.
Yeah.
But anyway, and so they kind of were like, so what are you getting your pictures taken for? And we're like, oh, we're doing a podcast. And we started talking about it. And the lady goes, oh my gosh, will you have someone on that talks about empty nesters? Cause I don't know what to do with myself and I'm going crazy. And I just need some advice on that. Do you remember that?
That's right. I totally forgot about that. They were so nice to her. Yeah.
It's a really big stage that people don't talk about. And I definitely think when you're in a, you know, either a religion or where a lot of women have stayed home, I think it's definitely something that's not talked about. And I almost think that people expect you just to, oh, wait, you're still the mother. And now you're the mother of this extended family. That's dangerous too, because you start feeling that way, then you get nosy and you get, you know, like you have all this advice for everyone, or you're trying to invite your kids over 24/7 when they have lives. And there's a balance to that, that you have to like be okay with. I have an identity. They have an identity, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so true.
Yeah. That's interesting to think about in a way, like, yeah, having a hobby, like you said, or having something that kind of helps you through that transition, whether maybe a part-time job or maybe you did have a career, you know, but it might help ease that transition period.
So, yeah. To have a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And a plan. I love all the advice you gave.
Yeah.
I was going to think, I just had written down the nostalgia piece that you talked about a little bit earlier. What was cool about that is, so we just read the book, The Atlas of the Heart by Brené Brown, and we did an episode about it. And she actually talked about nostalgia almost exactly what you said. Yeah, she's like, she it did. Can be I good. About the same thing, so I'm like, what you're saying literally is like what research backed. If you have too much nostalgia, it can actually, it's correlated with depression and things because we idealize those nostalgic points in our life. And I find myself doing that with when my kids were little. Like I see pictures and it's fun to look back, but I've got to be careful not to idealize it too much and just, miss so much when they were all little, you know, cause now we're in this teenage phase and there's hard things about that. And it kind of just reminds you like to be present in the stage that you're in and enjoy it while you can. But then when you're on from that stage, it's not bad to look back and be nostalgic, but too much of that idealizing of the past is dangerous. I shouldn't say dangerous. That sounds a little extreme, but it can be
because mentally I think it's dangerous. Like you said, I think it just locks you in. I remember one time I was talking to my son. My husband was out of town. Actually, he just stole my parfait right there, and now he's going to eat it.
Oh, he's next to me. Finish your breakfast for you.
Anyways, I remember my husband was out of town, and it was right in the middle. And I had gotten COVID, and I hadn't gotten it for like 3 years. And so I was kind of stuck inside in the summer, and my son and his wife had gotten it. And he said, oh, Mom, just come up and eat pizza with us since we've all had it. And I remember going up to his place and I'm in the freeway. I just started crying. Like I felt so lonely, like seriously. Mm. And I think sometimes people don't talk about that ache. I call it the ache, like that lonely. And I remember getting there and I was trying to get my eyes better. And my son looks at me, he's like, Mom, what's going on? And I just lost it. I just lost it because I just needed an outlet to describe that feeling I was feeling, that period of time where it was so isolating and lonely to me and I think that's okay to go through that period. I think it's healthy but you don't want to stay too long, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which brings me to like my next one, which I am what the next transition I'm going to talk about was
great.
Where I learned to be present, which I'm still working on. So, we have had a child that has struggled recently with substance abuse. And that was new. I always say, oh my gosh, that's a new pain. That's a new lesson or a new ache. I always call them, that's a new ache that I've never felt before. And, this child is amazing. And they had some real struggles as they worked through COVID and just with some of the background that they have gone through. And, but when we went through it, we had to learn some huge lessons. And one of the biggest lessons that I learned during, especially that year, was that joy and peace can exist during a storm. And at the beginning, I didn't think I could. I mean, I absolutely thought that it was the first time I realized I had zero control. And I think we never do. I really don't think we have as much control as we think we do.
Right.
But it was a moment where I was like, I have zero control here. And I remember, like, one of the perspectives I'll talk about with this is that I learned that being present is not only a gift to yourself, but to others. Because when you, like we talked about the past and the future, those both get in the way of being present. And when you're going through something as hard as watching a kid struggle and you do not know what the outcome is going to be, and especially because none of this ever happened when my kids were in my home, where you think you have more control, and then boom, they're adults and you're like, oh, I have way less control than I ever thought. And so what I had to learn during that period is that I worked so hard at reading and studying and figuring out how to be present, because when someone struggles, you're not present for others either as much as you aren't for yourself, which can be damaging. And so I had to learn during that time that, number one, I had to stop thinking that I had control. That was the biggest step, was I realized I didn't have control. And then I had to realize that you don't underestimate when you're going through a trial. I always now say, okay, I'm in the middle of it. I've been through things before and I know that there is an end. I know at some point I'm going to be able to reflect, but it doesn't help when you're right in the middle of it. But if you can just say to yourself, this life lesson that we're going through is going to help me and it's going to help my child. And then it helps you kind of start to get centered. And then the biggest thing I learned was, like, the phrase, this too shall pass. When you can say to yourself, this too shall pass, nothing lasts forever and pain eases with time. That was a really, really big thing for me, because I read between The Seat of the Soul and The Untethered Soul and No Bad Parts, all of these were these things that actually, in fact, I told my son the other day, I said, I know this is going to sound weird, but I really want to honor what we just went through, because even though it was hard, I learned so much. Like, these are the things that I right. took away from it. And I told him, I said, I don't think I would have dug that deep inside of myself had we not gone through it. And it's not like we're completely through everything. I mean, when you have substance abuse, you're working for years.
Always. Yeah.
And you're relapses can happen and things like that, but we're on the other side of the fear. And so that really shot me into the present, because I didn't have any other choice. If I was going to be there for myself and others, and especially my other kids, I had to learn how to take this reality and place it over here. And like for like you guys right now, if I was completely burdened with this, I wouldn't be able to be here. So right. I've done a lot of work on shifting, because what happens is that you can't do anything anyways, and you're eliminating yourself from experiences because you think worrying is an action word, and right. worrying is not an action word. It's just a feeling, you know?
Yeah. I think the control thing is so big, because you can make yourself go crazy. If you're trying to control it, try to fix it, and you're not in the present, then right. you're missing out. And then I think the other thing you said about, you can have like joy and stuff during hard things, like that, the word, and like you can have joy and be sad or be stressed. You know, even when my mom passed away, I remember, they had like a counselor come in, you know, as she was going through in hospice. And so all the grandkids and the kids were there, and the therapist said, your grandma wants you to be happy, and she knows you're going to miss her, and she knows you're going to be sad, but you can be sad and have fun mm-hmm. with your friends. You can be sad and enjoy your basketball game or whatever it is you're doing. Like, you can do both. And yep. if you stay in the sad and you forget to have joy, you're just going to be depressed and not have a good life. And life, this isn't the only sad thing that's going to happen to us. You know, like, there's going to be other hard things. And so that has been such a huge thing. And it's so simple that it's okay for sure. to be both, and you should be having both, you know? And I think that's interesting about funerals, of course, like the nostalgia thing, like my mom had been sick for years, but of course it was a blessing to only remember the good mm-hmm. because it had been such a hard time seeing her so sick. But as soon as she died, it was like, all we did was remember the good of mm-hmm. her. And so then when we were talking, it was like, we were laughing about her and smiling about her, even though she had just passed. Like, we were sad she died, but and happy we had all these memories of her.
Right.
So I mm-hmm. love that, because I didn't have control that my mom got sick. I didn't have control that she died at 63, and I don't think that's fair, but I can't control, you know, like, I can only control how for I sure. feel. I mean, how I react to these feelings. And so if I spent my time being sad and depressed, then I'm missing out on all this joy with my right. dad and my siblings and my kids and my husband. And
it's a protective, I think it's a protective thing our bodies naturally do, especially when someone dies. And I think also that our emotions, I don't know if any of you guys have done the Enneagram, but I'm an Enneagram 7, which is someone that kind of leans toward the good feelings, but also runs and kind of hides and distracts from the hard feelings. I'll give a perfect example. My sister-in-law passed away a year and a half ago. She was in her 40s in a bike accident. And I remember I was back east. We were helping with our new grandbaby. And when I got the news a few days later after she'd been in the bike accident that she'd passed, I went upstairs, got on my computer, and started looking at places to travel to, which was such a coping mechanism. That was like, I can't face this right now. I'm going to do this other. But one thing I've learned, like, I have a super amazing therapist and I believe in therapy wholeheartedly. And she's helped me sit in the pain. And I've realized that when I let those hard, I call them my shadows, when I let them flow through me and I stop resisting, they don't last as long. They flow. They're a different kind of energy, but they're a good energy. And I don't resist this angst inside of me that ends up getting me sick or ends up And so one of the biggest things that I learned, there was two things I learned through this. One was listen to others, and anyone that's gone through something similar as you, seek them out, take them to lunch, listen to everything they say and believe them. Because I had two significant people in my life that I love that I reached out to, and they told me what to do. And I instinctively didn't want to. And they said, okay, if you want to go 10 years, don't do what we're saying, but you're going to make this decision at some point. Do it now. And I was scared to death for some of the things that we had to kind of face and go through at the time. But I'm so grateful to them because they not only saved me years, but they helped me help myself. Like, they helped me do the work that sometimes it takes parents years and years to do. So I say fullheartedly, listen to people, seek them out, gain the wisdom that they did through. And if they can help you get through it faster because they didn't do something, because especially with addiction and substance abuse, you definitely try a billion things before you do the right thing. And especially for them and for yourself. So I would say that. And the other thing is that don't hide your struggles. I think especially in religious settings, I don't know why we do this, because it's not what we're taught. We're taught to bear each other's burdens, mourn, but boy, it is the place to hide. And the reason I say it is, and I think there needs to be a cultural shift in this mentality, because my friend, her brother died. He had some mental health issues, had some homeless issues and substance abuse issues, and he ended up dying. I went to one of my places of work and I knew someone there that knew my friend. And we brought together the fact that her brother had died. The first thing she said was, well, if he had been doing the right things and making good choices, and I was just flabbergasted. I was like, I came home to my husband. I'm like, this is why people don't say it. This is why when we're at church, we don't say my son has this, or my daughter is going through an eating disorder, or my blah, 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 whatever it is. We don't say it because if we had taught them better, or if they would have been better, right. Those are the damn answers that we get. And so people don't talk about it because we automatically think, oh, I guess I did something wrong as a parent. Oh, I guess if my son had done this, and it's just stupid. It's wrong.
Yeah. And it's so shame-based. Yeah.
It's the judgment. Yeah. 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 But then we internalize that. And it reminds me of the episode that you were on the At Last She Said It podcast. Mm-hmm. And it was, I had been following you for, years before that, but it was fun because I saw you on that and listened. And it was kind of about the burdens that we carry, as mothers, that we can control the path of our kids and the choices that they make. But and kind of how the church culture has fostered that. Though, like you said, it's like, it shouldn't be, because, there's, those, the things that you just said, what did you say?
Yeah. Mourn with those.
Yeah. All those things. But then it's this counter, I don't know. Somehow that culture just happens. I shouldn't say it doesn't always happen. I think there's some people that don't do that and some that do, but the overarching is yeah, well, that was going to happen mm-hmm. because they're not living the gospel or, you right. know, just kind yeah. of those.
Well, it reminds me, we had my mom's best friend, Karen. Well, she has, what's her married name now? Anyway.
Oh yeah.
I know her as Karen Lowell.
Karen. Yeah. She but was her, on her about
husband,
a year ago. Yeah,
her
yeah.
husband passed and then her daughter died of an overdose. And when she was doing the obituary, I think a lot of times you don't want to say that. You don't want to mm-hmm. say it's shaming. It's okay. How did I let my daughter get right. on drugs or have a relapse or whatever. You feel like it's your fault or you're ashamed of it or whatever. But she decided to put it in there in the obituary that she died of an overdose. And it changed like her healing process because she had yep. this woman reach out to her and say, my son also died of a drug overdose. And they've become best friends and been able to mm-hmm. help. And kind of like you said about reaching out to someone that's gone through it. This woman helped her through it so much, like just to like get through the death, get through, you know, all the mm-hmm. all the feelings, but to heal faster probably than she would have on her own if she kept that in and not like put it out there. Because this woman, we also had her on, Terry.
Yeah.
Her son died of an overdose. And she would, if she saw it in an obituary that someone's son or daughter died of an overdose, she would show up at the funeral. Beautiful. Even if she didn't even know them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just to mm-hmm. say, I know what you're going through. I'm here for you. I'm going to sit with you in your pain. Yeah. And I was like, that's so beautiful. But no one would have been there for her if she felt shame of that, you know, and being able to say, my daughter was addicted to drugs. She had a relapse and she died. Like, I do feel like you feel like, well, yeah, the judgment of like, well, how come your daughter got on drugs in the first place? Like,
exactly.
Didn't you raise her right? Didn't you teach her about the gospel? Didn't yeah. you, or whatever?
You know, it's what the hard. Blessing, and this might sound contrary to some people, but I'm really glad that my son wasn't active or participating in church during this time. And let me tell you why, because he didn't need the additional shame. He didn't need to go into a leader and have to confess something and then have to lose the sacrament or lose this or lose that. He didn't need that increased shame. That I really think that would have destroyed him to have that. Oh, he already yeah. felt enough by being in that place. And so I was really grateful that as a family, because I love my kids. They rally and they rallied. They rallied around their brother and That's they awesome. Still do. And so I'm just grateful that they didn't have to do that. And I think if we get better at being able to say it, then we wouldn't have these like cookie cutter answers. Well, did you pray? Did you read your scriptures? Did you, you know, do all of that? And well, no, those aren't the answers to some of this. This is way yeah, bigger right. than praying and reading our scriptures, right. you know, mm-hmm. and it's good to learn tools outside of our faith-based systems because people are educated and have gone through this. And there are answers outside of our religious institutions that we need to be finding, you know?
Yeah. yeah. Yeah, that's when you were saying, you know, about the books that you read and the therapy and all this, I was thinking, you know, I just admire that because I think it's easy sometimes to just sit in the sadness and kind of just want to hide from it and like, and be sad and just kind of, you know, go through the motions of life. But I think it is like, you kind of have to dig in and seek out things that can be healing and seek out therapy and the different things. Cause don't you think like, that's what kind of gives you the tools, like you're just saying sure. to get through those things. Yeah. But I mean, but then at the same time, sometimes it's easy to want to, and I just admire that because you were just saying, you know, you might be the person that just wants to Google something totally different that's going on. So obviously, you know, you resisted that a little bit and just dug into the healing. And anyway, that's super admirable. And it's not like, no, you would never wish for that to happen, but you've pulled the gifts from it that you could and, right. and actually bonded with your son over it, you know?
And, well, yeah. and it's, yeah. I'll admit we had like 6 or 7 weeks. That was the scariest part of my life. We're very, very like, we didn't know where our son was. And I mean, imagine that as a mother, like,
yeah.
right.
like that kind of depths of pain. And it was such a scary, scary time. So I'm not trying to make that it was all so easy, but
right.
those, I always say when you have to sit in the darkness, you have to, you not only do you dig deep, but I just think there can be peace in the darkness. And I think the darkness is necessary. And we all have to like feed into why we're there, why have we been placed in this moment. And I think everybody in the world, it doesn't matter what faith you are. Everyone has to go through those things where you dig so deep that you find out what you're made of, you know, because at the beginning yeah. you think you're just seriously just nothing. Like you really think
right.
you evaluate your every move. You evaluate your every parenting move, everything you've ever done. And maybe you need, like, maybe it's the process, but you realize at the end, like, no, this was a beautiful thing. In fact, I'll just tell this at the end. When my other son and I were reading The Seed of the Soul, which was a very good book for us to read together, he kind of tends toward more of the agnostic, or, you know, sometimes wonders about God and stuff like that. And so The Seed of the Soul is this very bonding book that we read together. And there was a chapter on addiction. And in it, it was so funny because when my other son was over one time, after this, I said, "Hey, I read this book and there was this whole chapter about addiction." And he's like, "Really?" And I said, "It's interesting." I said, "Because this author's, his ideas, you know, he didn't say he had all the ideas, but what he was thinking was that in a way we come down and have different experiences that heal different parts of our soul until our soul becomes what it needs to be. Kind of Mormons believe in progression. I think it's all the same, incarnation, whatever. It's all about progression, mm-hmm. right? We all are talking, we're saying the same thing using different languages. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so it said that like, maybe there's a during, maybe a soul says, I want to heal the part of my soul for addiction. So in this particular earth experience, that's what I'm going to do. And I said to my son, I said, it's so interesting. I said, maybe if this philosophy was right, maybe in another experience that I had, I dealt with that. I said, or maybe I haven't. Maybe I haven't chose to. And so I said to my son, I said, if I haven't and we have another experience, I said, please be near me. It got me really emotional. I said, please be near me, because I need the experience and the things that you're learning in this life to also help me heal that. And it really like touched him. He's like, what's the name of that book? Because it was like something that took the shame out of it. This is just an experience you're having. We are just learning from it. And we're grateful that we get to have it. And please, in the future, if one of us have to do it, be there for us.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Whether this life or beyond or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, and I think that's the key. And actually what's cool, I was just like this, I think this is why our podcast is so inspiring to us and why we love doing it, is we get to hear stories like this, you know, of people like, what did they learn from the hard things or not, you know, just whatever they've gone through. But yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So that's kind of that's it about that. And so we can move on to the.
Yeah, that was great.
No, that was so, I'm glad that came in and
And I'm glad it's important because it can be like, you know, you can take it if you have an issue with drug addiction or someone you love with drug addiction. But I think so much of what you said can apply to any hard thing.
Yeah.
That we go through, because
for sure,
we're all going to go through them. So
yeah. Yeah.
I love it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm glad, you know, he's doing better. And anyway, and I think he has the perfect mom to help him through these things. You just seem amazing.
Yeah. I'm a little.
I shouldn't say perfect. We're not striving for perfection.
Yeah, just our best.
But right? Yes, yes,
and learn as we go, and do better when we know better. So
that's the thing. Yeah. Do better when you know better.
Yeah, exactly.
Moving to your next transition. Yes,
what would you like to chat about next?
So next, I want to talk about like faith transitions, just because I feel like I'm in a very healthy place to talk about it, where maybe if it was a year ago, I wouldn't have been in a healthy place. For me, so my background is, you know, I grew up 100% LDS in the church. I was fortunate because, like I said, I had parents who opened up conversations. My dad came into the church later and he had known a lot of other stuff about our history. So he brought it to the table a lot. And very early on, he brought polygamy to the table. And oh my gosh, as like a 16-year-old, I thought I was going to die. And really, that one's never left me. But so I was kind of open up to these ideas and the ability to talk. And to be fair, the church was very good for my dad, because he came from a family that had some, you know, dysfunctions and some substance abuses and things like that. And wonderful parents, but there was a lot of, you know, poverty and things like that. And, and so it kind of like in his 20s, it really was good. It was a great landing spot for him, because it had that security and that structure that I, like Richard Rohr says, that first half life of your spiritual life is, you do kind of need to know structure and rules, right? Just so you know how to break them later, I guess. Yeah. How to think constructively. And so anyways, I had that. And as I went through in my late 20s, I really is when I had a crisis at the time, but it's just kind of an evolution. It's a crisis because it scares you. And my dad was just there for me. I mean, I was struggling with polygamy, but my dad would just take me out and we'd go out, and he'd always kind of be, don't throw the baby without out the bath. But what he meant was, there is good. And yes, I validate that this is. And so I kind of hung on to that. But it was still I'll tell you, you could do a whole podcast on polygamy with me, because it's honestly right. It was such a detriment to me and even my early marriage, because I felt like if that is a true principle, or even if it's taught, then I can't even show up in my marriage. I can't show up and be who I want to be or be, because I always had that in my head. What's going to happen in heaven? Right. What's going to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
in fact, I joke with this. I always say all the time, I'm like, bad marketing on the church's part.
Oh yeah.
Like if you're going to sell me that the top of the celestial kingdom, and this is what I'm getting, ding, 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 behind this door.
Is polygamy like, no, thanks.
I don't want to open that door. Like I kid with my kids. I said, you know, when I think about God, I don't want to think about angry God. And so when they divide up the kingdoms, I'm like, okay, if that God says this is okay, then I'm really, really good in number two. I still think Jesus is cool.
Yeah, I would say
cool.
that too, actually. I don't think I want to go to the celestial kingdom, actually. I'm good just right now.
Yeah.
I love what Jesus taught. They claim he's going to be there. But, you know.
Right. So that's all good.
And that's with me. I mean, I kind of believe in like a different. I mean, number one, I don't think we really know. But that leveling in kingdoms just didn't resonate with me. And so anyway, so moving forward, about, oh gosh, I think it's been well over 10, 12 years ago. I had this, I mean, it was a spiritual experience. And I really felt this strong inclination to learn about LGBTQ. And I didn't know at the time, nothing was being talked about. And I didn't know if it's like, ooh, like, why am I feeling this? And so I started to dig and I started to research, and there wasn't much out there. I found one family that lived in Logan. And I remember talking to my husband about it. Like, what if one of our kids came out? And a year or so into my search, I did ask him. I said, do you think I'm going through this because one of our kids is going to be gay or whatever? And he said, I don't know. And I said, the interesting thing was, even hindsight, my kids come to me and we laugh all the time. They're like, so at Christmas, do you want one of us to come out? Like, would that, you know?
My husband teases that too. And he goes, I think your kids are going to want to be gay just because you're so loving to the gays. They're going to be like, well, mom kind of wants me to be, so I'm just going to say I am.
Well, and I always kept thinking it was interesting. And I just didn't know. I thought, am I going through this so that I can experience? I'd ask them in high school, like, do you have any friends that are gay? And are they received well by their parents? I just want them to know that they could talk about it. Well, you know, my kids are straight and I love gay, straight, whatever you come down as, I love.
Yeah.
But so what it did was it just entered me into this world that eventually my son was waiting for a visa wait for his mission in Brazil, and he was in California and he was struggling out on his mission. He wanted to come home, and we were up at a soccer tournament and I thought he was going to come home. He had an amazing mission president there that just kind of said, yeah, I support you in whatever you do. So I was preparing for him to come home. And so while we're at this tournament, I see a number come across, which, you know, at the airport, you're waiting to hear from your kid, because he was either going to go to Brazil or come home.
Oh, wow.
So I see the number and I'm like, I normally don't answer those, but I answered it. And it wasn't my son, but it was the flight attendant from his flight. And he had gone. He decided he was going to give it a shot. And so the flight attendant starts telling me how great my son is. I met your son. He was so amazing. I just wanted to reach out and tell you. And I start to cry. And I'm like, you have no idea like what that means to me. And I was kind of telling her a little bit about my son. And then she starts to cry and she's like, well, you're the only parent that's ever answered. I'm usually leaving messages, but my mom tells me to reach out to the missionaries, you know, and the families. And she says, I'm so glad you answered. And then she said, well, just so you know, I'm gay. And I have my partner and we're getting married. And she said, and I told your son that I was gay. And he just looked at me and said, you know what? We love you, sister. And he said, that's what he said to me. And she said, and it meant so much to her. And so what was weird is we became friends. She ended up moving back to Utah. And the first time I met her, she called and said, Tony and I are married. We're going to have a baby. Would you like to come to our shower? And so so my daughter and I ran over to her shower, and it was this beautiful shower. I swear they had church music in the background. It was this big old Mormon family that was embracing, and I'm now really close to her mom. So I had these steps that led me in this direction, and everywhere I looked, and that's why I say people think you can't have experiences or spiritual experiences that go contrary to maybe what your belief system is saying. Yes, you can. And everybody has them in every faith system. And without faith system, people have experiences. So I will never deny that I was supposed to be in this space. So fast forward, so I don't take too long. We got involved in a lot of things. You know, we had started when Encircle came, volunteering. We just, and then we started game nights, like we just realized that there wasn't a lot of spaces for some of these people. So we started a Sunday game night, and then eventually we started a Sunday class that was super strong before COVID. And as you know how COVID changed things, but we would, mm-hmm. we would meet with like 30, 40 LGBTQ young adults. And on a Sunday, because they did not feel like they could go to church, a lot of them, but they still sought spirituality. So they do like someone teach about, they all taught it. Brene Brown was the topic, or sometimes it was Taylor Swift, whatever, you could learn from anyone.
Yeah.
And so we did that. And then my husband was bishop at the time, Elder Ballard had came out with that statement at BYU that said, listen to understand your LGBT brothers and sisters. And so we felt like we got a green light. And so we were talking about it. And so I said, you know, my husband said, let's do this. So he went to our stake president and he okayed it, not for the whole stake, but for our ward, and really had no questions. He was amazing. And so we put together a fifth Sunday and actually took the full last 2 hours of the meeting, and all of the ward came into the cultural hall, and we lined up chairs that were kind of like this semicircle. And then I said to the people I knew, just a few of them, I said, just so you know, if you want a safe meeting at church, this is the one to come to. And word spread. We had 140 extra people from the LGBT community the halls. I mean, line the whole back. And what happened at that meeting is we had two people that were still going to church that were gay men. And then they spoke. We had George and Allison, who lost their son to suicide, spoke. We had Morgan, who was married to Tony. She and her mom spoke because Morgan almost lost her life by suicide. And so they talked about that. And then we had another couple that was married, two females, talk about the opposite, the bad treatment they got from their family, whereas Morgan got the good treatment. And and it was beautiful. Like, you couldn't hear a pin drop. It was the most amazing thing. It was powerful. It was like heaven was resting on us. And oddly enough, after that, it only took one night. And, you know, when something like that has not been done, it went crazy. Yeah, I was getting messages from all over the world,
I know. I don't know even, I mean, obviously we're right here in Riverton, but it spread pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. And I heard about it. Yeah. But I was so like, I wish I would have been there.
I know. I wish,
you know, cause I had, like I said earlier, but like off record, you know, my sister's lesbian and married to a woman. And I was in that place wanting to find more inclusive, like, I wasn't like looking for it for her necessarily because she left the church a long time ago, but for me to feel like I have like-minded people that want to be inclusive, you know, and I think I told you about it, started following you on Facebook. Like,
It was crazy. And so we had all these things, and then, you know, you have the bad things that happen too. Like all of a sudden I see something that said, you know, Bishop has gone rogue in Riverton, and they were saying things about our stake president that weren't true. And so I'm like, okay, I got to get this out there and straight. So the funny thing is I collected pages and pages of messages, plus all the talks word for word. Plus I wrote about 9 pages, and I called the church office building. I wrote a letter to Holland I said,
wow,
hey,
you said this. So this is what we're doing.
Well, I knew it was on the radar, and I knew that we were starting to feel the pressure. Like the regional people heard about it, and there was pressure coming down like, oh, this is maybe should not have happened. And so I sent it all to Holland and wrote a letter, and within 2 days I'd get a response saying, come up to the church office building. He was out of town somewhere in Africa with President Nelson at the time. But he had read it, and he had us meet with someone else. So we met, and that was an interesting experience too.
So it was you and your husband. Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting because you go into the church office building and it's literally, it reminds you of the Truman Show, and you can see how people can get so insular and not actually know what's going on when you're walking around and everyone's just waving, smiling, saying hi. And not that that's bad, but it just kind of showed me like, I get it. I get why there's a disconnect, because this 24/7 place where you're feeding yourself with only church disconnects you from the world. And I don't say that as a whole, but that's what it felt like. So we had that, and it was okay. I had some good things to say, but certainly some pressure started to come down. And anyways, we stayed in the space for, my husband was like at about, he was at his 5-year mark then. So he went about 4 more months and we were released. And then after that, some interesting thing happened with me. Number one, you know, I've always kind of gone through a little bit of faith disruptions in my life. And so I had, you know, I had polygamy. I had blacks in the priesthood. I had two black children. And I had circled that one a billion times before I even decided to adopt. And then I have LGBTQ. So I'm drowning in all of these types of issues and things.
Yeah.
And, but I was determined. I was determined to make it work. Like even with my kids, I was like, we can make this work because I can, what do you call it? I can sift. When my kids come home from church, I can sift and be like, okay, what was good? Mm-hmm. What was not so good? And we'd talk about it. I can take the best parts and I can be an advocate and I can be an ally and I can do all that. And so I did do all of that. And, you know, as 2020 came and all of those things hit, we just had a shift as a family because we were in a space where we were not growing anymore. We were in a space where we were, you know how they say damnation actually means damning growth. You know, it's like damning, mm-hmm. they think it's damning your soul to hell. No, it's damning your growth. And we were in a spot where our growth was being damned. And so, you know, COVID made it super easy to kind of shift mm-hmm. in those spaces. Mm-hmm. Now, also, it was interesting because I was also being put in a position with priesthood leaders on it. Like there was a point when I was almost not given my temple recommend and I forced the issue because they circled back to the question about supporting, you know, other people. And I was like, what do you mm-hmm. mean supporting our love for other people? Like I pushed back and I almost didn't get mm-hmm. it. And I was going to get it. My kids were getting married and I was like, oh, this is a nice time for you to try not to give me my recommend. And I was just like, and that whole nother story, right. About what you have to do to be able to see your own kid be married. Right. And, so at that, and then also interestingly enough, my husband had only been out of being bishop for 8 months, had a couple of months off and then had his dream calling. He was teaching the 10-year-old boys in Sunday school, loved it, had only been doing it for about 6 months. And about 2 weeks after my temple recommend stuff, all of a sudden he was called in and I came to church a little late and I'm like, well, did you get another calling? What happened? And he's like, no, I got released. Oh. And, with no explanation other than at the end that the particular person had said, well, you know, my wife and I support what you're doing. So he had kind of said, I know what's happening. And so we were starting to get pushed out because our advocacy was too strong, you know, mm-hmm. and I will tell you that if you're, and I have a lot of friends that have gay children and they'll even admit this, the church kind of leaves you alone if you have a gay child in so much, because they're kind of like, don't know what to do with you. Like we want you here, but we also don't know what to do with your child. We're not going to push it. But if you don't have one, you are in the line of fire because I'm supposed to be a good soldier, right? I'm supposed to toe the line.
You're not getting the grace because you don't have one. Yeah.
Right. And so anyways, we started doing some stuff like that. And I even got some more pushback later by a post that I'd written that I actually thought was one of my best ones. I wrote it about the temple, really about the things that meant a lot to me. And I talked about Eve and how that paradox that she had to face and how she finally, as a woman, which I love that the church celebrates this, as a woman figured out in the garden that we cannot grow here. Like we are stuck. And mm-hmm. if we're going to grow, we have to step outside of here and face some things in life. Right. And God couldn't do anything because his hands are tied. You tell, you know, according to that story, you say, well, leave, then you can go back and blame God. You made us do this. Like that paradox is that we all have to make those decisions for ourselves. Right. And so did she. Mm-hmm. So I compared it to, there was a few conference talks that were sketchy, you know, that we get sometimes. There was another mm-hmm. one on LGBTQ. There was one on our Heavenly Mother. All I said was, you know what, if you're struggling with LGBT issues or you have a child, stick your big toe outside of the garden. I didn't say go outside, but stick your big toe and ask God, ask your creator. I asked, I got answers. I love them tremendously. And I am an advocate for them. If you don't think you can pray to a Heavenly Mother, step outside the garden for 2 seconds and ask. These are things we can mm-hmm. think for and do for ourselves. And in conference, look for I did say there are going to be talks that are represent Eve and that whole expansion of your mind and expanding of your faith. There are going to be talks that are Adam, that are good soldier, you know, do this, this, and this. And I'm like, choose what you want to put into yourself and feed yourself. Well, that got me into some trouble.
Oh, it sounds beautiful to me.
Yeah. But I actually think I remember that post.
I know, I do too.
Loved it. And I even feel like I've like told that analogy to a couple of people, like, you know, family members and stuff, as they've been going through faith transition. So thank you for, because I think it's a beautiful analogy.
Well,
and it's true. Like, it's a cool part of Mormonism that we look at Eve like that. Like, she was a progressive thinker in that way. And she knew that they had to leave the garden to experience the joy and the pain and, you know, all that life had to offer.
Exactly. Yeah. And the free agency that we tout needs to be honored. No matter what. And so in the end of this, you know, without going into too much detail on that, because I truly believe people are trying to do their best. And I truly believe even my leaders at the time, like, they were all doing what we were raised to do. And so I've offered backwards, looking back, a lot more grace than when I was going through it and was pretty angry about it. And there's, like I said, so much more to that. But slowly, you know, since COVID, we haven't been attending church, and luckily our whole family, all of our kids we're on the same page as far as like, hey, this house includes everyone. If you want to go to church, we will be there for every important thing that you have. If you don't want to go to church and you want to take your baby up to the mountains and have some type of a thing, we'll go to the mountains with you. Or we didn't care. And we just said, family's the most important. And I think sometimes what the church does wrong is family's important until you go away from what they think is family. And then you don't have a close family anymore. And that's in the Last You Said It podcast. That's what I was trying to get across was, listen, like, you are ruining your relationships by constantly worrying about whether your eternal family is intact. Work on your eternal family today. This is the day you have. So we kind of did that. So I have some kids. I would say the majority don't attend our faith system anymore. And some, all of them don't a lot, but some like have different ideas about it, but we're all on the same page. And mostly it's just, you know, to be fair, you guys understand that, and I know you get this, culture is a big deal here. And when you're outside of the culture, you don't fit. You are a square peg in a round hole. And so understandably, like I've told some of my kids, I'm like, I understand that that is a hard place to not fit into your neighborhood, you know, and all of those things. It's hard. And so I totally respect people that go culturally, you know, because they have people and they can take the best parts that they want to from that, you know? And so I understand that. My one son that I was talking about, he, in a little bit of, he was joking, but he can, part of his angry face, he said, Mom, you knew at 28 or 30. He's like, why didn't you get us out? And I was laughing. Right. I was laughing at that. And I said, well, let's look back 30 years ago and let's see what happens in our culture when someone leaves and what would have happened to you guys. Mm-hmm. And especially back then, there was no support, but we all have so much support now.
Yeah. I think it was so much different. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even just having Facebook and Instagram and podcasts, like you can listen to something or read something and be like, oh, this is, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy to have these thoughts.
You can connect with other people so much easier. But back then you would have felt so isolated. Like, and I think in a way, like you might just feel like you had to move, but like, what if you couldn't move? What if you had a job here? Or what if your family's here and you want to be around, you know, your grandparents and things. So it's and just, it's complicated.
What do you do when your whole, you know, your whole family's in at the time and everything like that? It's a super, super scary proposition. And to be fair, now that I'm on this kind of side of things, I can appreciate the fact that I was planted in the Mormon garden. Like there are things that I could not have been the same person without some of those early on things. And so I appreciate it. And I still to this day take the very, very best parts that I gleaned from that. It's just not my whole belief system anymore. It's a faith crisis turns into an expansion. And if we were all allowed to expand and get out of just this level of, you know, read your scriptures, blah, 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 that like kindergarten level that I call it. If we were allowed to expand, I think we would have a beautiful church community, whether people believe it or not, whether you believe it's literal or not, whether you believe, you know, because there's religion should be about messages, stories, anything that help us to live our lives better, in my opinion.
Right. And I think we should do like a petition to change it to faith expansion and stop calling it a faith crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like you said, the crisis is at the beginning because there's some fear. Mm-hmm. But as at least for me, when I've gone through it, like I definitely was expanding in my love for other people, mm-hmm. for my acceptance of other people, for my curiosity and wanting to know more about the world. Like it became a very beautiful thing and one of the most amazing things I've ever been through. So
it's the best. I would
definitely rather call it a faith expansion.
Yeah. But I have to say so it can be more of a crisis for some people.
Oh, because
if you don't have a supportive family or your spouse isn't on your same page so I feel like even for me, like I don't know why, because me and my husband have been, I think there is a crisis. I'm not saying like overall it becomes an expansion, but there's a phase that feels like a crisis. Oh, it does
at the beginning. Yeah.
But, and some people, yeah. Like think about the LGBTQ person themselves. If they're the lone person in their family going through a faith crisis, like
that's true.
It feels like their life could be at stake.
Well,
for example,
for me being as nuanced as I was my whole life, and when mine hit, it was a death to me. I grieved and I didn't realize mm-hmm. how much in my DNA all of this was. And it is a grieving and you have to go through the steps. And honestly, you do. And you have to honor people while they're in them. If you're on the other side, you have to allow that person to experience. You have to allow the person that may never go through it the grace that's where they're at. And that's, you know, that's mm-hmm. hard when you're in the angry stage because you're just like, why does people, you know? And so, but I'll share with you some of the things that I like wrote down as far as some of the things that you guys asked me. And to be interesting, everyone goes through it differently too. Cause my husband, you know, and it's interesting. We live in a space where we were, you know, a bishop's family, right? That's looked on differently. That's a scarier proposition
for sure.
to people in your neighborhood, because all of a sudden you're like, if it can happen to them, it can happen to us. And
that's really scary. Yeah. And, you're like a contagious. I felt like we were like contagious, that people didn't try to get us to come back. They like stayed away.
Right.
Like I feel like they thought that we were going to try to get them out, or, if the Garns could leave, then we could.
And like, you know, as well as I do, that we know that language. We've been part of it. We've mm-hmm. been to those meetings.
Oh, we've thought some of those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Where people, you'd say, oh, what are we going to do to get those people and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's from the best intentions. It's what we all knew.
Sure.
And it's what they knew. Mm-hmm. But they also it's a little bit sarcastic, but I kind of call it the happy, shiny people shun. Nobody knows they're really doing it, but they know that there is an element that maybe to me is like, oh, there's a doubter. I've been instructed to not get too close to the doubters. So they're mm-hmm. just doing what they feel like they need to. And it's lonely. That's why we grieve too, because we feel like we've been ousted, even though we kind of oust ourselves. Like it's complex. So
yeah, it is.
Yeah. And I have to admit, like me saying that it was such a beautiful thing, I do come in a place where my husband and I were on the same page. My kids were all on the same page. We don't have really intense families, and most are inactive or not part of the church. So it was for me an easier transition. I can see if you were the one lone person, like you're saying, whether it's LGBTQ or just someone going through a faith crisis, it could be, very hard, very devastating. Yeah.
And I know my privilege. Like I have privilege.
Yeah.
My husband and I, same page, although his transition was like, I laugh at him because it's so different for us. Cause he's like, I get it. Like it's time to grow somewhere else. He literally just is like,
that was kind of my husband. Super easy. I like internalized all these things for so long.
But you know what? They get a little bit of male privilege in the church. You know what I mean? We have quite a few more things that we have to deal with. And same with us. I have all my kids were on the same page, very open dialogue. My parents mm-hmm. were awesome. I have a number of siblings on my husband's side of the family. And so I tend to be like, okay, I need to hold space because most of the people I know do not have that. Absolutely do not. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I'm going to tell you some things that I've learned so that, you know, I don't take all of your time, but this is some of my perspective.
This is great.
Is that like, I now, instead of seeing like a neighborhood, a ward, a stake, that type of family, I now clearly see that we're a human family. Like that makes so much more sense to me. Okay, here's a perfect example. I'm sitting on a plane. In the past, I hated when they told me to preach the gospel because I'm not good at that. I'm not good at being like, oh, do you want to read the Book of Mormon?
You want a Book of Mormon? Yeah.
But you feel the pressure. Like, but I'm not mm-hmm. sharing. And so in the past, when I was on a plane and you get this good conversation with someone, you're in the back of your mind like, oh my gosh, maybe I can share the gospel and, you know, and mm-hmm. all that. And that's kind of overall feeling you feel. Now on a plane, I talk to someone and it's amazing because there's nothing there that's that, oh, I no have agenda, to do this. Yeah. No agenda. Mm-hmm. We just get to be friends. We get to talk to each other. We get to learn from each other. And I don't have a need to convert them. And sadly, back in the day, right when email came out, I met one of my husband's work colleagues. We were at a work meeting and I met his wife and we got super close. And I had young children at the time and email just came out and we became email buddies. And it was the best part of my days is this exchange I had with this person that wasn't Mormon, that was teaching me new things. And I had little kids so I could just go and have this little adult conversation. Well, it went on for about 3 years. And guess what happened? All of a sudden I hear a church lesson and I'm like, oh gosh, I've been friends for so long. I should introduce this to her. I did. Done. It was over, our friendship. Yeah. And I regret that to this day. Sad. To this day, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't over, but it can change considerably to where, and I was like, I'm so sad that that happened, that I felt like I had to do that. So anyways, that's kind of what some perspectives I have. And then the biggest one is that relationships are so much more important than being right. And it doesn't matter which side you're on. If you're on inside and you have kids that leave, your relationship's more important. If you're on the outside and you have kids or family or loved ones that stay, your relationship is more important. And that's what we should be focusing on. Because we all know that joy does not come through a checklist. To me, joy doesn't come through a covenant path. And in the end, don't we all know that our Creator's just bigger than all of that? You know, and that's what I think. Like, it's just granted, some parts of your life you need a list. You do when you're little. Your mom gives you a list for the chores. You learn how to do chores. But that's to grow in those stages. But if you get stuck in that stage, you impede your growth. So that's one thing that I have new perspective on. Some of the things that I have learned, like I said in my bio, is that uncertainty has taught me way more than certainty ever taught me. And to be fair, uncertainty is the scariest damn thing I've ever been through because you go through really scary stages. Like, I had a nihilistic stage. Like, we were backpacking with my son.
And no purpose. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, have you guys seen The Good Place?
Yeah. I love that show so much.
Okay. So at this stage, I'm watching The Good Place and I'm seeing that green door and I'm in Italy with my son and his wife because they had lived with her and we were backpacking. And at every moment that I had this beautiful moment, I'm like, I'm done. I'm going to go through the green door. That's what I felt like. The green door is where I'm going. It's going
to
be done.
That's all I needed to do here.
Yeah. And I did go through like a nihilist stage. I went through a lot of stages. You know, sometimes you just have to go to a stage where you don't want to even consider religion. Because, man, when you lose faith in your own, there's not a possibility that you can have any faith in anything else. But certainty in the end, uncertainty is the biggest blessing of our lives because it's another thing that puts you in the present and it forces you to say to yourself, I don't know, but I do know that I exist at this moment. And I do know that what I have at this moment is real and I'm going to make the most of this moment. So I love it for that. I also thought, like in my bio, is to trust your inner voice. Like when I learned to trust my inner voice. Now, you guys see me on Facebook and you probably think, oh, she just can say it, but that's different than what's inside your heart that you're still having angst over. A lot of times you say it because you also need to hear it, right? And you need to keep convincing yourself because for so long, you're like, well, what if I'm wrong? You know, those kind of things go through your mind. And the other big thing that I have learned is that I was always worthy. Worthiness is garbage when it's used the wrong way. Like we are always, always worthy. And if free agency is real, then we're supposed to be using our free agency to not only learn from our struggles, but it just proves that we're worthy during our struggles. We're always worthy. And so that's a big thing that I learned. And then, like I told you before, everyone's doing the best that they can, inside or out. It doesn't mean that I still don't get angry at times. And frustrated, I especially direct it toward priesthood. I know it's just the thorn for me because I was an outgoing person, which, you know, gets you callings. It just does. I don't believe it's the spirit that tells them. They just want someone that gets the work done. So between my husband and I, you know, we served in almost every capacity that you could serve in. And the hard part is that, like in my husband's callings, they get the final say. In my calling, I never got the final say. I got shot down and you know, I'd have something mm-hmm. going on that I felt like was so warm and welcoming to even to the whole neighborhood. Cause I always wanted to cross over and say, we need to be neighbors, not, you know, and I got shot down so much that I just started going, this is ridiculous. Like as a woman, that was very difficult for me. So I struggle with men, and I struggle. The last encounter I had, I was invited to come and speak with a priesthood leader, and I declined. I said, I respectfully decline your invitation. They don't know what to do with that. They have no idea, because as a good soldier, we all do that. And that was very hard, but like for that person, but so liberating for me. It was like, wait a minute, I don't have to do that. I can just say, no, thank you for the invitation, but I politely decline and I'm good with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. It reminds me of just like, you're taking back your own authority, like instead of the patriarchy, because obviously there's good men everywhere, but when they're in this system that just, they're used mm-hmm. to it. Women don't have to say no to them. Even the men that they preside over don't have to say no to them. And I think that was a shift in my mind too, when I was realizing like, oh, I don't have to say yes to a calling, or you don't have to say, you call me in, we're there, you know, well, we'll see if it works for my schedule today or whatever, you know? And then when you start to trust that, then it's like, well, wait, what else is there that, you know,
absolutely.
Of my own inner voice and intuition.
That I can listen to myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that I can make my own decisions.
With callings, I would tell people that are working really hard on the inside or believe full heartedly, still use your inner voice. You know better than mm-hmm. they do what your life circumstances are. If you get a calling, go in and say, okay, I'm going to go home and think about this. Don't answer right then. Go home and think about it, and then be good with what you're sharing. Because there are just times, I remember one time I was camp director and I had everything ready. We're a new ward, so I had to get all brand new stuff. And my son, one of my sons struggled with debilitating OCD. And at the time we had him in different therapies and at the hospitals before and all of this stuff. And I couldn't do it. And I just literally within a month before went and said, I've done all this. I'll give you my preparation. Someone else needs to take charge. And I think that's okay. You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I think it's so good, because I think it's so hard, because I feel like they say family first, but really it's God and church first for so many people.
Calling.
And so I think it's very brave, and which it shouldn't be brave. It should just be what you need to do. But it was brave to say, you know what? No, my son needs me and I can't do this. Mm-hmm. But I feel like we feel like we can't do that. And that's sad, because I think people should be able to stick up for themselves and what their family needs, or feel like they can say no, because they would know better themselves than anyone.
I was proud of my husband, because when he became bishop, and my dad had been a bishop, so I had kind of gone through it as a kid. And my dad was a good example of this too, but when he was bishop, and I still have some resentment still, but even though I had it way better than others, you know, we decided that we weren't going to have it interfere as much as we could with our kids and our personal life. So he did a lot of stuff on Sundays, and then our kids were teenagers, so young men's night was fine, but he didn't do anything on the other days. And we decided that as a family. I also decided, I went completely I was missing in action most of those years, because I needed to protect my kids. Like even the first day he was bishop, my 16-year-old was told by someone, oh, now you have to be the example. You better, you know, like almost like you better be perfect. And he came to me crying the day my husband's put in, and I just sent him home. I sent him home. And what was so awesome about that is I went over to tell my husband the day he's put in, I said, our son is struggling. And my husband went to them and he says, I have business to take care of. And he went home and sat with my son.
Oh, wow.
And then
that's amazing.
And then as far as like, you know, you don't vacations, some bishops never take a vacation. They have to be there. And my husband told his whole leadership thing. He said, listen, go whenever you want. I don't care if none of us are here. Someone can always take charge. The young men's president, I don't care.
There's plenty of people. Yeah.
That's such a healthy.
We don't need to share like, I'm out of town, you're out of town. You go out of town because you know your family. The only regret I have is that, we'd miss maybe two Sundays at times, like if we were doing something big, but, you know, at that time with my teenagers and where we were at in life, we could have done some really cool things as a family for like a month. Like in the summer, we could have been gone an entire month, and our whole summer didn't have to be, look how short what do you have? Like 8 weeks, and you have young men's camp, young women's camp, youth conference. And you're like, when do we have time? Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. There's a lot. Yeah.
And so
keeps them busy through the summer in the church.
Yeah. And so some of that, I look back and go like, you know what? Like we lost some of those moments. But, you know, that's life, right? We all have to, that could happen in any of our life stages, in any of our religious or non-religious stages. We might have some of those. So that was kind of like, those are some of the lessons. Some of the things that I would advise to others, and I would say this is in or out, because I think they would be a valuable thing for me if you're attending. And I don't even say out, like, you know, I feel like our DNA, like my DNA is Mormon, you know, and I will have ownership over that. You know, I know the language. We were just on a trip to Asia and, you know, you run into someone that's a Mormon and I know the language and I can easily love and appreciate that their kid's on a mission and all of that. And so no one's going to take my DNA and my ownership from me and, or how I choose to show up for it now. But one of the things that I would advise is that, like we said before, you are going to have stages of grief. And as a nurse, I really studied this a lot. And I advise people to not skip any stages. I think that you are going to be in denial at the beginning. You're going to be like, what am I going to do? You're going to start to bargain. If I do this, will this happen? If I do that, will that happen? And you're going to be angry and before you accept. And you're going to hold some deep grief no matter what, because it's so much inside of us. And here, an example of this is in 2020, our neighborhood was, they did this fun run and we thought, well, let's go out. You know, I was kind of out in my mind by that point and we weren't going to church anyways. And so we went out and my husband, my other sons went for a minute, but we're going on a bike ride. And I was standing in the midst of all of these people, all of a sudden realizing how much I didn't fit there in that space anymore. And they weren't doing it. At first you kind of think like, oh, I'm standing over here and they're all over there. I was part of that, but it was very isolating and very hard for me to look at that and be like, oh my gosh, this is, I don't fit. I don't know if I ever did, but I'm not fitting in these great people's, what they believe lives. I just don't fit. I went home and right behind me is our countertop. And I wept like a death. Like I wept and I didn't know anybody was home. My daughter was sleeping in and I had forgotten. And she heard me and she came down and she's like, Mom, what's wrong? And it gets me emotional. I just turned to her and I said, Abby, I'm grieving. Like I am just grieving right now. And it was the first time like I allowed myself to just say it, because it was always there, but I just tightly held it in. You know, I'm going to soldier through this. I'm going to blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And so I grieved and it was such a necessary part. And then what I had to do after that, and this is what was really good for therapy for me. You have to not believe what people are going to say about you or anything that you think they might be saying about you, which to give grace, maybe they're not. And I'm just thinking it, but I, you know, thinking those things like, oh gosh, Susie's not going to have joy or happiness in her life now, you know, and those things kind of weigh you down. So you have to mentally work on not believing what you think people are saying. One time I went to therapy in the middle of the summer and I had a very cute, modest sleeveless shirt on. And, which is funny, more modest than what we mostly did when we hung out in our workout clothes all day. Right.
I mean, right. Exactly.
Everyone can justify wearing your workout clothes all day. And
for sure.
I went up to my husband's office upstairs cause he works from home. And I said, hey, I'm going to therapy. And I put a jacket on and it was July. And he's like, that's interesting. Why are you wearing a jacket? And I looked at him and I'm like, well, that's an interesting question. And I,
why am I
wearing a jacket? And I went to therapy that day and I said to my therapist, I'm like, I had something I wanted to talk about, but it switched. We're going to talk about why I'm wearing a jacket in 100-degree weather.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know why I was wearing a jacket. I didn't want to walk out to my car. I didn't want to walk out to my car with my heaven forbid
garments on,
sexy shoulders showing.
No shoulders.
Right. Yeah.
And that was hard for me. And I had to do a lot of therapy on like, how can I be confident enough in myself that, cause it's not my problem what other people think of me. That's their work. Right. That's their work to do. If they're going to like internalize me in a tank top, that's not my work to do. And I had to kind of go through that process. So to advice to others, inside or out, Don't believe yourself when you say someone's thinking something about you.
Yeah. I think that was one of my biggest, probably one of the hardest things for me was not only whether I heard what people were saying or not, I would make up what I thought they were.
100%.
I bet you anything, this is what they're thinking of me. And this is what they're saying about me. And I didn't like what I was making up, but that's what I thought they were. And it's kind of that control thing. I cannot control how they see me now, what they say about me. I just need to be my true self, which my husband kept reminding me. In the end, they will know you're still the nice, kind person that you were before. You just so happen not to wear the same underwear as them anymore. Or you go to brunch on Sunday instead of church now.
Yep.
But it doesn't mean you're not a good person. But it was really hard for me. Like, I would just make up these crazy things. Or if I did wear like short shorts or something and be like, oh my gosh, I'm like, okay, but of course I'm not going to church anymore. Of course. Or if I had a cup of coffee with me, like it took a while for me to be comfortable, like going out like that when I can't control what people think. It's not going to like, I don't know. It's just a weird mind game that you have because I think you do care about the people and you want them to still like you and think you're a kind person, but you also want to be you and be like, I don't know. It's crazy.
It's a weird mind stuff that really happens, especially for women, I think, because we had so many more rules, so many more conditions that we couldn't have double pair steerings. We couldn't have, all of these things. Yeah. Like for me, like, with me saying being a gypsy, like it's true for me. Like there are things that I was like in going, that doesn't make a hill of beans. Like my home health, when I was in home health, my very LDS older people had to drink coffee so their bowels would work. And I'm like, that's so silly. It's bean juice that's actually healthy. Everything in moderation. Yeah. Great philosophy from Mormonism. Moderation is
I do. A wonderful I actually, blessing. That is one I take for sure. And I tell my kids all the time that.
Like, yeah, same. And I think that all the time too with anything, you know, but
moderation is good.
But research it and find out like, okay, that's not bad. But before when I'm like, drinking caffeine from other sources that have a lot of other additives, sugar, and things like that. Yeah, let's like use our minds. We're trained to use our minds. And then I had to do like through all these stages, I had to forgive myself for once being what I don't like what people are doing. I don't feel like I outwardly like judged, but I know I inwardly did. I know that I think it's because I was jealous, I think I was like confined and I was like, okay, since I'm confined, let's do the crab theory. And maybe I should be mad that that person's not wearing their garments. And mostly it was because I was so insecure with myself. And so I would advise like, give yourself some grace. Don't judge. You know that people are on their own paths. And like you said, when you're worried about people, like behavior over time, like as we go through these stages, we always say behavior over time equals trust. And as you go through the stages, you have to afford other people with their behavior over time to work that out of what they might feel about you. Because it's not you. It's just the system that they're working against.
I mean, I did have like a couple friends, like it was really hard for them that I was leaving. But part of me was like, how does this affect you? And one felt like their mission was to get me to come back. And I finally said, I want to be your friend, but I cannot have you taking the stress on of my salvation because this is not your responsibility. And I want to be friends with you and I want to like keep our relationship going, but this cannot be part of our relationship.
No.
Like and don't be stressed about me and don't think this is your calling in life. Like you've got your family, your beautiful family, like just do your thing and we can still be friends without this as part of our your mission in life. It was hard.
Wouldn't you love to be able to say to everyone, like, listen, take the most purest parts of the gospel that you believe in and unleash yourself from thinking it's your responsibility to keep everyone there. Just do the parts that we're all supposed to be doing. Love your neighbor, cry with me. Cry with me in my faith crisis. You don't have to understand it. Like, I'm not going to push it on you. Just allow me to mourn it without assuming that I'm leaving for other reasons that you think are, And so, just learn to sit, just use the gospel. And I wanted like give them a magic pill and say, you don't have to worry. All you need to worry about is having us in your lives and having a relationship with us, you know, but it's complicated, right?
Yeah. And I think you said something earlier and maybe before we were recording, but like, enjoy today. We for sure have today. So don't worry about what heaven looks like. Like if you have family members that leave, spouses, kids, and you think that you're not going to be with them in heaven, then how much more important is it to be with them today?
100%.
Instead of pushing them away because they don't believe like you believe, or they're not living in a way you feel like is the right way to live. If there really is an eternity and they're not going to be with you, then it is so much more important to like cultivate that relationship today and in the here and now.
If you're right, or you if your beliefs end up, let's say it ends up right, then take the escalator down. That's what I always say.
Come like, visit, right?
Don't be so busy up there that you can't. I mean, there's these options that you can come and.
Yeah, yeah. Just come down and visit us. We'll be hanging out. We'll have a good time.
It's not the end of the world. I mean, the funny thing about our culture as Mormons is that we will worry about everyone and take every second of every day worrying about them until they die. And then when they die, we do their temple work and we're like, oh, they're back with us anyways.
And yeah, like, that's true.
It doesn't.
It's like just enjoy. And you do hear that it'll all work out in heaven so much that you're like, wow, if we could just use that and not ourselves stress, that it's just all going to work out. Like just have a belief that there's some loving like connection that we all have that it's just all going to work out. Then it can be way less stressful.
Yeah.
I think atheists, like I think people give them too bad of a rap. I had a person come to me that her husband was atheist and she's so upset. And I finally said, I said, well, back up for a minute. I said, I have a brother-in-law that's an atheist. And I said, do you realize that like the pure atheists are probably some of the best humans? I said, because they believe in the here and now. They respect the earth. So they do so much to make the earth better. They respect their body because they do want to live as long as they want to, because they don't think there's anything else. And they respect their relationships. And I said, in a way, they're almost living it better than the rest of us.
Right. And they're not doing anything for a reward or fear of punishment. They're just doing it because they want to be a good person. It's not because God's going to smite them or reward them. They just are doing the best because they have and one life to live and one moment to be here. So
There was a thing that I was going to share, and I know we probably have to close up in a minute, but like I travel a lot, and I do it because number one, I'm like an escape artist. And so I sometimes have to get out, but a lot of reasons my family did. My dad always took us just even back east for like 3 weeks at a time, just to show us how different people lived. And I think that has value. But as I've been studying like the different kind of faith systems that are out there, and you have the Western part and you have the Eastern part, and the Western part is so great because it's so collective and you unite together. The Eastern part's so amazing because it's so individual. Like you're just working on yourself. And possibly both are needed because we're creatures that need community, right? But we just don't know how to really combine them. And with some of the things that I've been reading and working on and meditating over is that, like, I really myself believe that we're kind of part of this collective consciousness, you know? And we learned growing up in our faith that our Heavenly Father can reside in us, right? Like that we can have God within us. But even more importantly, I think that also means that we reside in God or whoever the creator is. And so we spend all this time going, trying to make sense of the world. We have to have this big, powerful being up there, make up all these rules and things just to make sense of the world, right? Yet we all have it within us. And so if God's with us in us and we're with God, we are collectively God. And so all we need is each other. Like it's seriously as simple as that. We have all what we need within us. And I think in the end, like I know people like look at energy as kind of woo-woo, but in the end we are all this particles of energy that,
yeah, I love that,
you know? And so I just think like, we try to make sense of the world that it ends up being things that either hinder us or make us push down others. Right. And in the end, we just we're collective humans. We're a collective body of humans. And we just misconstrue what God means, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like simplicity makes it much easier, and it might be being comfortable with the uncertainty, which I am. But if I just think of it as simple, like you said, we're just all here to help each other and God's within us and, you know, we're within God, but then we're all one and we're helping. That's to me is just like beautiful and simple. It takes away all the just stress and the judgment and kind of feeling like you're right or your belief system is the only way. And then it just seems like we're more one.
Yeah. Right.
In that way.
Yeah. So that's what I was thinking. The thing that sometimes gets in the way of that, well, any kind of superiority, you know, whether it's, you know, race superiority or mm-hmm. religion or lifestyle, like, because I was just thinking as you were saying that, like, it's so beautiful, but why can it be so hard sometimes, you know? But I think, and, you know, like you were saying, like, back to your thing being on the plane, like, I've had literally that exact same thought. Like, now I can go right on an airplane and talk to someone and not feel like, and yeah. again, but I know that that comes from a good place too, but there's something about just letting go of any superiority, like, even with belief system mm-hmm. and just believing, like, we all mm-hmm. have something to teach each other. And the person that I meet on the plane that's an atheist or comes from a different religion has as much to teach them Absolutely. As I could teach.
Yeah, teach you.
Teach me as I could teach them. So anyway, but I love what everything you just said. I think that's like perfectly yeah. said.
Yeah, well, I think it covers humanity. I think it covers people mm-hmm. that are like, I believe in energy. Okay, we're all one source. We're just using mm-hmm. different language.
Different words.
That's
yeah.
all that
Yeah, like
doing.
You said earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all kind of the same thing. It's just a different way. You know, our different religions give us the different language to explain basically the same thing that everyone's yeah. seeking and feeling.
My son said the one that said, why didn't you get out then? We came full circle after like reading that book. And he says, Mom, he's like, I kind of think that maybe our experience down here, we had to learn what didn't serve us. You know, there were a lot of things that yeah. did, but we had to get to the point of like, what doesn't serve us? There's no regrets. I was placed in the Mormon row of the Garden of Earth, mm-hmm. right? That's the row I was placed in. But you find what doesn't serve you. And my husband has an awesome analogy. I don't know if I can get it right, but it's about a guy that's swimming with a canoe and he's getting down with the canoe. And then he gets up on the shore and the route's changed, right? He's trying to get up this mountain. And at first he was using the river and had the canoe. Well, he starts to go up the mountain, but he's carrying the canoe and he can't get up the mountain because the burden of the canoe is his route to get up to the same mountain had just changed. So he has to place the canoe down in order mm-hmm. to keep going up the mountain. And then maybe something else you'll have to place down. Maybe it's too hot. You have to take off your sweatshirt. And so we're all trying to get up to this destination using different methods, different ways that suit what we're individually going through. And we have to respect that in each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. And reminding ourselves that there might be some things that I have to shed along the way. And it can be really hard because sometimes you're like,
I spent so
much time and this got me through this hard thing or whatever, but mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah. But maybe it's time to put that down or maybe not, you know, but
yeah,
but just figuring out our own paths. Yeah. Depending on where it leads you.
And depending on what you go through, that's why I give people grace mm-hmm. too, is that I don't know what's ahead for them. And so if I hold or harbor too much anger because I think people don't like me or don't understand what I've done, I can't be there for them if needed when they face something similar, like maybe have a substance abuse or maybe have an LGBT child or maybe whatever. I need to make sure my door can be knocked on. And mm-hmm. and I've had to work on that because my angry stage was difficult. And so I'm sure some people are like, oh, she's scary. But I'm okay with that because I needed to go through that in order to get to where I am today. And so I hope people understand that.
I think it's important. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like the grieving and the crying, the anger mm-hmm. needs to come out as well, or you'll mm-hmm. just hold it in. So yeah. All those stages yeah. have to go through.
It is the stages of grief. It really is grief, like yeah. going through a faith transition or evolution. I do feel like you hit all those stages.
Yeah.
And sometimes you come back to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes I think I'm done with them. One and then yeah. they come back.
Yeah. Cause it is such a big part of us. And like you said, we're always, you know, whether we're still in the church or wherever we are in our faith journey, like I feel that way. I'm like, I'll always be, that's always a part of me, you know, wherever right. I land or whatever phase I'm in. It's just, yeah, it's part of my DNA. So
yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Well that was so great. Yeah. Do you have any last thoughts or anything before we kind of wrap up?
I don't think so. I think I probably over-talked, which is what I normally
no.
do.
No, I've loved everything.
No, I just, yeah.
Good advice.
I want to say thank you so much because I feel like everything that you've talked about has just been so valuable. I feel like you had such great like advice for listeners and for us. And I just feel like there's a lot more for me to even just think on. I'm excited to listen back. And I was taking notes as we were going. And anyway, it was just wonderful. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it was really good. I feel like you're just in a stage ahead of us. I'm like, oh, I'm learning so much for her. Even just the future empty nesters and all the.
I said, like, I think this saying yes to this podcast, it's like, this is why I think there's no accidents. Like, you know, spiritual things or things can come into your lives, because I honestly needed to vocalize some of this and I didn't know how to. So I was like, I don't care if I'm the only one in, you know, like I needed it for me. I needed to be able to say the things so that I could kind of wrap up some things that I've been through, and maybe it will even like benefit some of my friends and family
that
don't always understand the complexities of what we go through in this process. And maybe they'll be able to be like, oh, I don't need to worry about her anymore. You know?
Right. And I feel honored that you would say that, because it's like, I've watched you from afar for years and admired you. So now it just feels like an honor that we could talk to you and maybe, you know, help out in some way with your journey.
So, it was tremendous.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Oh, good. That means a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Well, at the end of our podcast, we always ask, how do you find beauty in life after going through your transitions?
How do you find beauty? For me, it's that because I have techniques and tools that help me enter the present. I've realized I don't always have to go all the way across the world to sometimes escape and find the beauty. I don't know if it's the how, but, or just the awareness now that so many things around me are so much more precious. Like, I think my transitions and things in life have brought me to a place where I recognize this is what I have. This is today. And so most of the time I can appreciate sitting in the ache. You know, I talk about that ache. Mm-hmm. Sitting in the ache can be beautiful to me because I know there is a turnaround at some point. I know there's something that's going to be, it's going to evolve from it. And so I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of that. I'm a complicated human. I go through a lot of kinds of emotions, and maybe that's why I didn't always fit in certain places, but I honor that about myself now. And I don't let anything constrict that side of me anymore, because it's so important to honor yourself.
So, yeah. I relate to everything you said, and I love what you just said.
Yeah, so much. I feel like it kind of summed up, because so many times you talked about being in the present. And I feel like what you're saying is find beauty in the present, even if it's an ache, but find beauty.
Yeah, and through all these transitions that you've been through, like, I love that that's, you know, the main, not, I mean, there's many lessons, but such a valuable lesson to take away from that.
And some of it's even age. You just start to go, oh my gosh, like, you realize after so many hard things that you were stronger than you thought. You made it through and you found value in it.
Yeah. I know. I hear it a lot, or see it on Instagram a lot. You've 100% made it through your worst days.
Yeah, 100% awesome. Of your worst days
you made it through.
Yeah, I know.
However you say it. But.
Yeah, and it always kind of, when you see that one, you're like, oh yeah, I have.
I have. I'm here. I made it.
And it's helpful. Yeah, it's helpful to think of it that way. So,
yeah, we're resilient.
Yes.
More than we give her. Yeah, we sometimes believe in ourselves. Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been awesome. I've loved hearing all your
thanks for
stories and transitions.
Great. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you so much for listening today. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and would love if you subscribed to the podcast and followed along as we continue hearing more inspiring stories. You can also follow us on Instagram at Beautiful Shifts Podcast, where we will post updates with our latest interviews.
We'd like to thank the band We the Lion for giving us permission to use their beautiful song Move Along for our podcast. Take a minute to listen to the song and the lyrics and enjoy.
I find a way to know myself. All my thoughts are mine again. And begin to understand where to go. Now it's time to move along. Now it's time to move along. Take this journey as my own. Feel the strength right in my bones. All I want is to believe. Life is my own, life is my own. I'll start again, my mind is free now. I can feel the truth in me. I'll take a chance, I won't be wrong. Yes, now it's time. Now it's time to move along. Take this journey as my own. I feel the strength.